31st of March, last day of March.
Tomorrow's April Fool's.
Is it? Tomorrow's April Fool's Day? Thanks for warning me. I'm a sucker for those things. I always get nailed.
Let's see what I can bring.
This is the Subcommittee on Human... Don't bring anything up. This is Subcommittee on Human Services. It's 8:35 in the morning. We're going to kind of turn things around here. We're going to do a couple of work sessions first because we still have a quorum, and Representative Nathanson asked us to do it, and I think it was a wise thing to do. I also want to apologize to the committee for not being here yesterday. I got hung up in the clinic and missed my flight back up to Medford.
Oh.
Duh.
I still think you ought to come on Sundays.
Yeah. Well, that was when the flight was. So I was a little late getting up here yesterday morning, and I appreciate you. I watched you guys on tape.
While you were flying?
No. I was driving. No, I watched
while you were driving?
No, I watched it yesterday at lunchtime. My staff helped me. And I thought you guys asked very pertinent questions about PEB and OEB, and I think it's going to lead to some more questions we have to be asked later on. But you guys did a great job, and I appreciate it. And sorry I wasn't here. So with that said, you want to introduce us to these two? Yeah. Okay. Are you ready? So I'm going to open a work session on Oregon Health Authority Health Policy Program's Health Information Technology Grant.
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, so we'll start out with the grant that's focused on exchange of health information, and then after that there's a colorectal cancer screening grant. And then once we finish those, we'll start into the agency presentation for public health.
Where's the IT grant? Come up and introduce yourself to the committee and for the record, and tell us about this grant. And brevity is your best chance for getting yes votes. So
great.
There you go.
Thank you so much, Senator Bates, Representative Nathanson, and members of the committee. My name is Susan Otter, and I am the Director of Health Information Technology for the Oregon Health Authority. And I'm here today to request approval for submission of a federal grant application to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. The grant is offered by the Office of the National Coordinator for Health IT. The grant is called the Advanced Interoperable Health Information Technology Services to Support Health Information Exchange Grant, which is a nice long title. It's offered to states or state-designated entities. The Office of the National Coordinator anticipates awarding 10 to 12 grants. The grants are for $1 to $3 million over the course of 2 years and anticipate them starting in June. The purpose of the grant is to focus on health information exchange and interoperability. We are working with a subgrantee on this grant request, which is Jefferson Health Information Exchange in Southern Oregon. Their proposal is to focus on consent management around health information exchange, including behavioral health providers and their information. This is a key area of priority in Oregon for our health information exchange policies and strategies, is to figure out how to effectively include behavioral health in care coordination and electronic health information exchange. Jefferson Health Information Exchange is a nonprofit that's supported by 5 coordinated care organizations and the hospitals in their region, which include Jackson, Josephine, Klamath counties, and the Columbia Gorge region. Jefferson HIE has 580 providers and 120 clinics that are connected, as well as the CCOs that I mentioned in the hospitals. So the goal is to engage behavioral health, primary care, and emergency providers to exchange information and implement a consent management process. The purpose of our role is really to pass through the funds to Jefferson Health Information Exchange and to oversee it and monitor the grant and to learn lessons from that. The grant requires a 25% match. The match can be met through in-kind contributions, and that is our intention. We will meet the match through services provided by Jefferson HIE, including their staff time, stakeholder meetings, and purchase technical tools. There is no federal requirement for maintenance of effort. No new positions are needed. No state funds will be contributed to the match. And I'll stop there.
Questions? Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The Subcommittee on Information Technology has been hearing presentations from state agencies, a number of state agencies. There's no way we'll hear from all all of the boards and commissions and all of the agencies, but we have been hearing a lot of presentation. I've also noticed that there are several bills moving through the legislature this year that are either from Oregon Health Authority or related to Oregon Health Authority work. One of the things that interests me about the idea of this grant, it concerns me really, is it happens all the time that we develop a system on its own and we haven't done the appropriate kind of planning ahead for how this system may connect to other systems in the future, mm-hmm. how data might be shared. And then the legislature is asked to fund projects to either replace systems or fund some sort of interoperability project or scrap something and start over because it doesn't talk to another system. I understand that this is really intended for Jackson, Josephine, Klamath counties, and the Columbia Gorge region. But how is the state CIO office going to be involved in thinking through, at the big picture level, how this should unfold?
Representative Nathanson, Senator Bates, thank you for your question. The Office of Health Information Technology, which is the office that I administer in the Oregon Health Authority, we have a strategic efforts around supporting health information exchange across communities in the state of Oregon. And we work with the state CIO's office on any technologies that we implement, any projects that we have. We obviously have to go through all of the state CIO requirements for our work. In some cases, like this grant, we are really facilitating and supporting the work that others in our communities are engaging in. We had an excellent opportunity to hear from our communities in a listening session efforts that we undertook last year and in 2013 that led to our strategic planning process to consider some of those exact concerns that you raised around siloed systems that our CCOs, our hospitals, our health care providers are investing in, and interoperability. This is a key challenge across our nation, and one that the federal level they're engaging in as well in efforts to implement standards that help with interoperability. So the state CIO's office, we are keeping them updated on our efforts to support exchange of information within the state, and obviously they're a key player in all of the work that we do directly.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I'm really glad to hear the conversations and the collaboration that are taking place already. Even though this is somewhat separated, and as you pointed out, the state is facilitating this, mm-hmm. the state is using its resources and its name mm-hmm. and its time to facilitate this. I think the state does have a stake in it, mm-hmm. and I think the CIO's office should be more than aware, but at least involved minimally in the initial planning, so that we avoid problems that we've had in the past. I personally don't consider this, oh, we're just passing this money through to someone else. It's part of our mission. It will help achieve our objectives, and we do have a stake for the sake of all Oregonians.
Okay.
Makes sense. It really does.
I'm going to follow that just real quickly, and I have to tread on this kind of lightly because I'm peripherally involved with this. In the state of, we have a state in Southern Oregon called the State of Jefferson. And, you'll have to have a passport to get in soon. We're working on that. Our problem in Southern Oregon, as it is across the country and across the state, is we have systems that don't talk to each other. Mm-hmm. I can get information quickly and easily on patients from OHSU because we're mm-hmm. on the same Epic system and they've got it worked out. But I can't get the same information from my hospital across the street, which is also on the Epic system, but I can't get the information. We just walk over and get it. It's a block away. And we have about, I kid you not, okay, and we're working on this. We have about five or six functioning systems, different doctor's offices, a different functioning system at Providence in our area, which is also Epic, but I can't talk to them either. What they're trying to do down there is get these systems to talk to each other, whether it's, you know, Athenia or Greenway or all the others. There's about, I think there's seven altogether, maybe eight, in our region. Mm-hmm. And I've never quite understood why the Columbia River Gorge area is involved with this, other than I guess they're trying to learn the same stuff. Mm-hmm. The question I'm getting to, is this sort of setting up just a way of getting consent from patients to allow information to flow, or are you really going to be looking at trying to code and build some portals between these systems? Because that's something I think that would be very helpful to the whole state if we learn to do that, mm-hmm. because we can do it statewide in it. And that will go back to what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I mean, I don't know how much progress they've made. I don't know how this is going to help them. Clearly, I'd like to give them as much help as I could. I actually called down this morning. I couldn't find anybody that knows anything about this because they're all getting their kids off to work and school, and I don't know what's going on. I didn't find out about this. So what is this money actually going to be used for?
Senator Bates, thank you for your question. So you have a couple questions in there, actually. So let me just start with Jefferson Health Information Exchange is a functioning community health information exchange currently. They offer point-to-point referral services, and they're adding a community health record component. So the idea of a community health record is that the hospital data, provider data, laboratory data come in from all different providers and locations into one community health record. So there's one record for each individual in that community. And then the providers and care team that are supporting that person can access that one record with all the information. So they're doing that now with the investments of the hospitals and the CCOs in their area. What this funding does is it allows, they've been very challenged with bringing in the behavioral health information. So under HIPAA, consent is relatively known, straightforward under HIPAA for providers that are physical health providers, that are active treating providers of patients. With behavioral health, we have an additional layer of federal requirement under 42 CFR Part 2. That requires explicit consent for patients receiving alcohol and drug treatment. So that's a challenge from a policy standpoint and a technology standpoint to manage that consent. What this grant does is it helps them identify a common consent framework, a common consent tool, a consent form that would be used, adopted across the community, and then the consent technology to be able to manage that consent. So, for example, if a patient has received explicit consent from their treatment provider and the consent from their physical health provider, that those can share that treatment information for alcohol and drug treatment, you have to be able to manage that consent electronically and within their health information exchange system. So it's some additional functionality in their system.
So I'm going to go back to Representative Nathan's question. If they get the grant and they're successful in doing this, the state office should be aware of it and they can use it across the state potentially for other areas?
The consent model and the consent form would then be models that we would think would be valuable absolutely across the state. And that's one of the main areas that we think why this is a high priority for us as a state from a policy perspective.
I don't want to spend too much time on this, but it's a small grant. If it comes through, great. But if it doesn't, we're wasting a lot of committee time here. Any other questions?
I do, but I don't think mm-hmm. we're wasting time because this is a big, huge issue that we need. So just a question. What's the probability of you receiving the grant?
Senator Bates, Senator Winters, thank you for the question. I think we have a high probability of receiving the grant. It will be very competitive. As I mentioned, 10 to 12 grants will be awarded, and it's only going to states, so out of, you know, the 50-plus states plus territories. I think that Oregon has a good reputation when it comes to our health reform work, and there's folks like to invest in us when we have grants right now, particularly around health information exchange. So I think we'll have a competitive grant, but I think there's a good chance we will not receive it.
And follow
as well.
This chair. Because there really is a lot of concern about this particular issue, and I would just agree with my colleagues that perhaps there probably should be a report coming back to the body through the stages of the development. Even though this is passed through to a nonprofit, I think that there's a high interest in this particular issue and its replicability to the rest of the state. So I would recommend, you know, if the grant, if you're successful in getting the grant, that there is periodic reports coming back to this body.
Can you do that for us, Susan?
Absolutely. Thank
Thanks.
You.
Thank you. I entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move approval of the request to apply for a grant to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services in the amount of up to $1 million a year for 2 years to support the exchange of health information.
We have a proposal. Mm-hmm. Any opposition? Seeing none? You got it.
Thank you.
And we need a carrier on Friday. Senator Winters will be the carrier. Okay. Thank you. Close that work session and open the work session in the Oregon Health Authority again. Colorectal cancer screening grant. I know you're all excited to hear about this.
I am.
Very necessary.
Really important.
Good morning, Senator Bates, Representative Nathanson, members of the committee. My name is Karen Gerard. I'm the Health Promotion and Chronic Disease Prevention Section Manager at the Oregon Health Authority. And I'm here today to request permission to apply for a colorectal cancer screening grant from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. It is a 5-year grant up to $800,000 per year. The intention of the grant is to increase colorectal cancer screenings and will specifically focus on reducing disparities among Oregon's Medicaid and Hispanic population. Colorectal cancer is the second leading cause of cancer death in Oregon, and it is an incentive metric for the CCOs. The proposal that we'd like to put forward proposes working with the Intercommunity Health Network as a pilot project in the first year and continuing the work that we learned through that with other CCOs and throughout the grant cycle. The expected outcomes are to increase provider and patient reminder systems, educate the target populations about the need for screening, educate providers about screening quality standards and the recommended screening tests, and increase use of health system data to improve evaluation and quality. In addition, the grant will support a number of statewide efforts through partners such as the Health Transformation Center, the Oregon Primary Care Association, the American Cancer Society, and local public health departments. The goal of the grant is to reach 80% screening rate among adults aged 50 to 75 by the year 2018. There are no state matching funds required for the grant, no expectation of maintenance. There is no need for the grant does not create any new positions, and it repurposes existing positions to meet the requirements of the grant.
Questions?
Just one, because this is very needed and necessary. Mm-hmm. Where you plan to have the pilot project?
Thank you for the question, Senator Winters, Senator Bates. The pilot is with the Intercommunity Health Network, CCO, to start. They have approached the Oregon Health Authority for help in increasing colorectal screening rates. Excuse me.
What counties?
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. The counties include Benton, Linn, and Lincoln counties, I believe.
Are those the highest populations for the Hispanic population?
Senator Winters, Senator Bates, the IHN approached the health authority earlier to work on this issue together to increase colorectal cancer screening rates for that CCO. The proposal is to use this as a pilot project so that we can move forward with the learnings with the rest of the state. The screening rates for the Medicaid population and the Hispanic population are significantly lower than the general population, and it is consistent in that CCO as well.
I appreciate that. I'm trying to get to where actually the broad pool of individuals are residing in the state and that particular age in the counties that you mentioned versus the counties where I know that there is a much higher population, and I'm just questioning why those counties were not included in the pilot.
Thank you for the question, Senator Winters. It is certainly an important issue for every CCO, and as that CCO was already working on this issue and approached the health authority for assistance, it was a natural jumping off point to continue that work.
If you get the grant, can it be awarded to any CCO of your choosing, or does it have to go to the one that's asked for it first?
The grant, we will be much more competitive with an organized agreement with a particular CCO going into the grant, but the intent is to have it be a pilot project to continue beyond that.
When are you going to submit the grant? When will you be submitting the grant?
The grant is due on April 14th.
I would suggest that you have a quick look at the counties, and I have a hunch which county has the highest population of Latinos.
Washington.
And Marion.
I think it's Marion County, possibly. I don't know for sure. Mm-hmm. And at least contact them and see if they're interested in this grant also. I don't know for sure what that number is, but I think Senator Winters has a good point. And we can do a quick look at that and find out which county has, if there's one county that has a significantly larger, or a CCO has a significantly larger number of Latinos in it, it would seem more likely that you get a better effect with your grant in that situation. So a quick conversation with them, I think, would be worthwhile. And you might find they're just as eager to do it as the next county is.
Thank you,
Chair.
Yes.
Thank you very much. You know, I'm going to play devil's advocate for 1 second. I appreciate the points that my colleagues have made, and I agree that those are not the three counties that I would personally identify as having the highest. But I do think that they represent an important point, which is to say that the Latino population is becoming more dispersed among the entire state, and those are counties that have significant rural areas. And figuring out how to reach minority populations in more rural areas is an important outcome for a study like this, where you don't have logical population centers, and it could be a useful model for identifying how to reach harder to reach populations. And it also may be that with a smaller population, it's actually more affordable to do that as a pilot project, whereas if you go to a county like Marion or Washington, which are probably the counties with the highest populations, it may be cost prohibitive to do something like this. So I appreciate the points my colleagues have made. It's probably worth reaching out to the CCOs that serve those two counties. But I would argue that doing this in the three counties you originally named has some logic to it as well from a study perspective.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Winters.
I just want to have one other caveat to put on this, and that is because the screening is age-related, and because it is age-related, I think that those demographics should actually play a part in selecting those which counties are there. So I'm not sure. Couldn't be definitive that those counties actually are the 50 and above, but that really is the age that we're all trying to encourage the individuals to get those screenings. So I would join my Senator Bates and say a call may be worthy. And also, I think your public health department should be able to tell you those demographics as far as age.
Senator Olson.
Representative.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, sorry.
You elevated.
I didn't mean to. Yeah.
It's O. Yes. S-O-N. Yeah.
Representative Olson.
So thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Bates. So, Karen, this is the first time you've ever done anything like this for the pilot project with the three counties like this.
Representative Olson, Senator Bates, we currently have a colorectal cancer screening grant, but this is the first with a pilot project, yes.
Okay, and follow up then.
Oh, absolutely.
And I take it, you didn't mention it, that Samaritan Healthcare Services are the ones that approached you, so it would be Dr. Larry Mullins that. This doctor is extremely creative, very visionary, and I can see him wanting to pursue something like this. This is the first time I've heard anything about it. But honestly, I'm really, because it happens, two of those counties are my house district, but yeah, I think it's a great idea.
Representative Olson, also they had approached us before this grant opportunity became available, so we were already working with them on this very issue.
Okay, well, thank you.
Thank you. So, well, Representative Boone?
You forgot. How come I'm not senator? I couldn't resist.
Because Senator Johnson will be more likely to beat up Senator
Johnson. No, Senator Johnson. Well.
You are. We're giving you that time. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Karen, and thank you for doing that. I have a couple of things I wanted to ask, and they might be dumb questions, but I think that having at the very beginning sat in on a couple of organizational meetings for CCOs, one of the things that came up is that they would be able to ask the Oregon Health Authority for assistance and guidance and vision and all that, and I see this as part of that. The other one is, as you said, it was 5 years, and so I was going to ask, is it all 5 years just for this group of three, or a couple of years to get it going and then maybe apply it to others as they require it? Or
Representative Boone, the intention is to work with the pilot project in the first year and expand as far as we can with the remainder
okay,
of the grant.
Maybe that would, sorry, follow up.
Yes,
just
absolutely.
Comment.
Go
maybe
ahead.
That
go
would
ahead.
Help alleviate some concerns of Senator Winters.
Thank you. I don't want to, just real quickly, this is an important topic. Are you going straight through a CCO, or are you going to go through the through a wider system, because CCO is basically cut off at 68, 65. There's a few dual eligibles they pick up, but for the most part, they don't track after 65. That's a Medicare population. What's the plan there?
Senator Bates, as you know, most of most CCOs have other books of business, and certainly we hope to affect broader than the population that we're targeting, but sorry, I lost my train of thought. We do have dual eligibles in that population, in the Medicaid population, in that CCO. I could get that information to you.
Yeah, I just got to think of the age thing. It's kind of strange, and that makes it more important than what Dr. Mullins would be doing. He'd be reaching a broader population, age-wise at least. Mm-hmm. That's interesting. We want to think that through a little bit as we go forward. Okay.
You're so sharp.
A question for the two docs.
Yeah.
What is the age of cutoff for screening?
We cut them off usually at age 80. You stop having to have regular screenings. I think it's 85. It's 80, I believe.
I think
but
we
there
do
are,
it the same way we do breast cancer screening, yeah. Which is if you anticipate the person's unlikely to live more than 10 years.
That's political answer.
But there's caveats to that too. If the patient has strong family history, yeah, or they've had previous abnormal screenings, or something happened, then it's different. But just for routine screening, I believe the recommendation is age.
50 to 75.
Then 75. We cut it off at we cut it off at 80 in our area, but we'd probably like to.
Maybe they're living longer down there.
Well, we had a great place to live. I don't know.
Mr. Chair, no matter what
I say, it's going to be wrong this morning.
Would you like a motion?
I'd love one. Yeah. Okay.
I would really like to make a motion at this point, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, thank you.
I move that we approve the request to apply for a grant to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in the amount of up to $800,000 per year for 5 years to increase colorectal cancer screenings.
We have a motion. Anyone opposed? Seeing none, approved. And we'll need a carrier. Friday, who's going to be here? Anybody in the House going to be here Friday? Full? Want to do it?
Andy's down on
his county.
Well, you're not on full.
Oh, your county. You do it.
It's your
I'm
county.
I'm not on full. Sorry.
You have to be on the
full committee. You didn't want me there, so.
Nope, nobody
yes,
wants
sir.
To do
that.
I'll take it if nobody else does it. I'm just reading the ponies.
Just read the ponies up
to
do this.
No questions, right?
You want to take it, too?
No.
I'll take it.
No one's going to ask any questions about it.
I'll take it.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Davidson. So I'm going to open a public hearing and send a bill 5526 and 5527 at the same time. It's public health. And please come forward. It looks like it's going to be Lynn Saxon and Lillian Shirley all coming up. Lynn, are you, you're listed, but you're not, are you presenting?
I'm here to provide moral support and encouragement.
To them or to me? Thank you. Please introduce yourself to the committee and start your presentation, please.
Good morning, Senator Bates, members of the committee. My name is Lillian Shirley, and I am the director of the Public Health Division in the Oregon Health Authority.
Good morning, Senator Bates, members of the committee. My name is Bill Coulam. I'm the OEJ budget director.
And for the record, I'm Kate Nass with Department of Administrative Services Chief Financial Office.
Thank you for this opportunity to present this work to you today. I am, it's my first time, so I'm a little nervous, but hopefully we can get through this with Kate and Bill here. I have a long history in public health, but I'm just so proud to present the work of so many people working toward the health of the state of Oregon today in this agency. A strong public health agency is really helps us get our educational system transformation as well as our health system transformation. Governmental public health, as I like to say, is we reduce the demand for costly health care service, so we're in the demand reduction business. That's our branch. Of the health authority. We work to improve lifelong health of Oregonians with numerous partners, particularly on the local level, both governmental partners as well as our community-based partners and agencies that work in the nonprofit sector. As you know, the Oregon Health Authority Public Health is a proud agency founded in 1903, so it has a long history. We were originally founded to respond to infectious diseases. That's the history of public health in this country. Originally, it was pneumonia, tuberculosis, and diarrhea in 1903 that were the leading causes of death for Oregonians. And today, we have a lot of those same old infectious diseases are still around, but we also have new infectious diseases, which are a constant threat that we have to be very vigilant about. And this year particularly, you all are aware of our work in Oregon to protect people from the Ebola virus, from the flu, from E. coli, from meningococcus, and we've had isolated cases of West Nile virus, whooping cough, continuing with TB, as well as vigilance around resurgence of SARS viruses in our communities. So it's still essential that governmental public health work with disease surveillance, immunizations, our regulatory programs, our public information capabilities to let people know kind of what's going on in real time and how to prepare themselves and protect themselves, as well as our response to remain critical for protecting health overall. Now in 2015, our greatest threat, we're going to be looking at our 2015-17 budget, and in this context, our greatest threat today are really chronic diseases and injuries. Tobacco use and obesity are still the largest contributors to chronic disease in our state, and they result in things like heart disease, stroke, many cancers. You were just discussing the second leading cause of cancer in our state, injuries, COPD, they are now the leading causes of death. We look at significant progress that we've made, and we'll show some here through some of the policy changes and the work that you have led in past legislative sessions that have shown positive results. So I think of public health as we're the agency that does for individuals things that they can't do for themselves. When you turn the tap water on, you know, we're the people who make sure that the water in your homes is safe. And then radiation levels. When you go to get a mammogram or your kid needs an x-ray for a broken arm, we're there to make sure that the machines that they're in use actually are able to produce the safe levels of whatever the diagnostic problems that you need attended to. We look at when you go in a restaurant, we have close relationships across the state through local communities with restaurant associations. So when you go into a restaurant in Oregon, it's one of the safest places to go into a restaurant and eat. And we can guarantee that you will enjoy your meal and not get sick. And we also work with other agencies like the Department of Transportation, Parks and Recreation, the education to really look at where people, where highways are, where recreation centers are, and how we can make safe and prevent disease through where we live, work, and play in the environment that we're in. We do have 715 positions, 695 and 0.35 are currently filled. And our budget, which we'll talk to in much more detail, is a total of $528.7 million. The majority of that comes from federal funding, and we'll be getting into that in a little more detail. Okay. So what does that money buy for Oregonians in the last year biennium? You can look. We have some of our results here in these honeycombs that go across a variety of programmatic areas. Public health, when we look at our org chart, you'll see a number of ways that we're organized structurally, but there are over 100 programs that deliver services. And some of the work that gets done we responded to 672 outbreaks, disease outbreaks, in the last biennium. We had 552 health alerts that went out to providers, practitioners, local governmental public health agencies about things to be aware of that are in the environment that we've noticed. So we have this systemic kind of approach where we don't do things alone, we can only do them with our partners, but our results result hopefully in really helping Oregonians wherever they are and whatever their socioeconomic status be able to be safer in where they are. One of the things besides the programmatic results that we're able to quantify is, I think, one of our main deliverables to the people of Oregon is information that we provide. We collect and analyze data in a variety of from a variety of sources. We actually have currently report on 50 health indicators across the state by county, and those are updated continuously on our website. In the old days, you had to wait till the book got printed, but now we can actually update it as the data comes in. And that's much more useful for communities and nonprofits to see what's actually going on in the county that they live in for those health indicators. We work with healthcare organizations. We respond to them. We provide data with registries and cancer screenings. Senator Bates, do you have a question?
Well, I have a question here. I have one, too, but Senator Sarah Hayward has a question.
Okay, sorry. I don't know when the right time to ask this question is, Ms. Shirley. I'm having a little trouble with some of the math on this slide. I'm looking at the number of birth certificates you guys issued, and I'm looking at the number of newborn screenings that you did. And I'm really having trouble with the arithmetic. I thought we only had about 45,000 births a year in Oregon, but you've got almost four times that many, three to four times that many number of birth certificates issued, and you talk about screening 288,000 newborns in the biennium. So I know we do two rounds of screening tests, and those encompass multiple tests. So I get the millions of actual tests done if it's that many. Can you help me get the math here? Because I'm missing something.
Well, no, you're not missing anything, Senator Steiner-Haywood. You've called out, really, they're apples and oranges. Birth certificates are issued not just for people who were born
this year.
That's
what I almost got.
Okay.
Then I looked at the number of newborns. I mean, I sort of got it, but the number of screened, that part you didn't get.
Yeah. We provide screenings for five states.
You're including. Okay. Now it makes perfect sense.
Activity
I apologize.
That we provide
I get it
contracts
now.
For other states like Alaska. So they don't have that capacity with their lab.
That makes perfect sense.
I feel like a third grader wanted to jump up and down. I know the answer.
Sorry about that. I should have
probably
know it
better than I
know this one.
I did know the answer, and I didn't put it all together. And so thank you for reminding me. I appreciate that. Okay. I apologize.
No. But I did have a question. A lot of what you do is going to be changed because of ACA. You've always been the place of last resort for women and children and men sometimes for health care because they had no place else to go. And you guys did a great job across the state, especially in rural areas, but in big cities too. Before the session is over, can you give me a little jot down of how you see your programs changing? The House is looking at this very carefully. They've got a long-term program plan they're putting in place with the health care committee on that side. I'd like to see what they come up with, but this is going to change. And I think you're going to get back to doing what you initially did back 50 years ago, really looking at the communities on a wide basis and doing the things need to be done for communities. Safe water, clean water, those sort of things that are really more important on a mass basis compared to individual care of patients. So like, give me an idea what that's going to look like and what you think is going to change. A lot of your money comes from federal grants, and we want those grants to continue, but maybe they should be put into a different place. So this kind of, you must be thinking about this, and you know that change is coming. It's got to be huge for you.
Thank you for your question, Senator Bates. This question, the answer to this question is going to take up the next year of this department. We are absolutely aware of it. And as you pointed out, we'll talk a little bit more about that, getting ready for the changes, not only the creation of the CCOs, but the Affordable Care Act on the national level, as well as the work that is being done by the House and Senate Healthcare Committee around modernizing public health system. And you're absolutely correct.
Okay. If you can give us a rundown of that towards the end of the session, I really appreciate it. Okay. Senator Winters.
Thank you. You brought up, I think, a very, very, very important question looking at the future. This agency has always been heavily federally funded. If you look at the numbers, the majority of it through a number of funding streams. And the question that was in my mind of whether you put together the plan B, because those funding streams may or may not follow over into the CCOs, looking at nationally what is taking place and looking at, I think we all better be prepared of, as time goes on, the diminishing of those federal dollars. So, it's not just this agency. I think others need to be thinking about plan B and what really will the priorities be. So
I couldn't agree more. I know one CCO that's actually supporting a local public health office, because without it, they would have had to close. And so we're going to see those kind of partnerships occurring. But Senator Winters' point is well taken. We don't want to be losing our federal funds, because if we reorganize at this level and have to backfill the general funds unless we really need to. So it's going to be really kind of tricky. But you're going in the right direction.
This is public health's lifelong health of all our people of Oregon has been our vision, and our mission is to promote health and prevent the leading causes of death and disease and injury in Oregon. Our strategic plan goals for 2515 that we've put up there are four areas. These were basically built on looking at what the leading causes of death are in Oregon, population health issues as of 2014, what's not improving over time for Oregonians. We've been trying a lot of different things for a number of diseases, and what do we need to recommit ourselves or look at other solutions for? And where are we in national rankings? And what are our winnable battles? One winnable battle nationally that we've done very well in Oregon is the rates of teen births, for instance. So in the way these strategic plan goals align under what we've done as the State Health Improvement Plan, and they follow from a series of meetings that we held with the update. We went around to different places in the state and held community meetings, sometimes on our own, sometimes tagging in with other community meetings that were happening, and asking if we could have a time on the agenda to show the community what the epidemiology data was, what was their experience in their own communities, and how they saw this coming out for an overall state health improvement plan. The organization of the division that we have now is basically divided into three areas, which you see on the screen in front of you. There are 16 sections that the work is clustered around in those three areas, and as I said, there's 100 programs that are represented across those areas. If you look at the Center for Health Protection, that's basically kind of here and now. These are the intersections between human health and the environment, where people, you know, get their services. This is where you find a lot of the regulatory services that the Oregon Public Health Division does. The promotion area is kind of looking at tomorrow. How can we prevent things and promote health for the future? And that's that section there in the middle. And then the practice section is kind of immediate. These are the people who respond to the emergencies that we have right now. These are the people that do the surveillance work, as well as work with our first responders and our emergency preparedness across the state. This enables public health, looking at our organization this way, enables us to really support the broader efforts of health system transformation to the points that Senator Bates and Senator Winters were making. If we get better understanding of how things are aligned and clustered to respond across individual programs and centers so that we're not looking at things just kind of as one-offs, but where can we really leverage and support the work of health system transformation. And also to support emerging areas of importance, such as the human exposure to toxins and reduce duplications and improve our operations. We share evidence-based practices across the programmatic work, but I also think it's important because we are dedicated to increasing equity, both equity among disadvantaged populations for whatever reason, including geographic equity across our state, that this really helps us to look at how we can share those emerging evidence-based practices, because things that work in urban areas don't necessarily work in rural areas or frontier areas. So how can we adjust our approaches to get the goal that we need to reflect those community-based realities that we face across the state. The position funding, we're going to talk a lot about later, but we do get, to Senator Winter's point, we do get a lot of our money from the federal government. About 8% is funded with the state general fund, and that accounts for about 57 of our FTEs in that area. And 32%, or approximately 220 FTEs, are funded from the fee revenue for public service and safety programs that we provide for businesses and individuals across the state. And then 60% is funded with federal funds. So this is a challenge for us. It's a challenge for us every biennium to align what the federal grant opportunities are and the federal priorities are with what are the priorities in communities across Oregon for what they need. Okay. So as I said before, we did do a population listening sessions around the state, and these are the priorities that came out of it. They're based on the epidemiology or the burden of diseases that are found here in Oregon. We also identified these as, these are actionable problems. These are things that we can, as a community, whether we're in the not-for-profit, the healthcare industry, or governmental, or community-based public health, we can actually see that there are practices that we can look at through the community guide, things that have been researched, things that have been worked out, things that have come from our community's suggestions, so that we can actually come together to address these in different parts of the state. And the state health improvements plan is really focused on the future. We are still doing, we promise, surveillance and being very careful about emerging diseases, infections. Oregon has one of the shining national examples of programs that are between healthcare providers, healthcare hospitals and systems, and our surveillance systems around hospital-acquired infections, so that we're still working on that kind of basic infrastructure of how do we keep our communities well, at the same time focusing on the future. They do represent the leading drivers of the outcomes that we get when we talk about our state health outcomes. These are the things that really are behind the scene that have people sick.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And you're still representing me.
God bless you. Okay. Well, boy, that's a collection right there. I'm looking at that, and I'm thinking those are a lot. And I find that interesting that the reduction of tobacco is at the top like that and everything, because we're leading the country right now on suicide rate. I'm actually kind of a little stunned that that's down the list like that, I was just jumping on the internet and I'm seeing that we're 41% higher than national average on suicide. So
Senator Bates, Representative Olson, thank you for the question. It's a good, what you're pointing out is these are not ranked. These are all
okay.
A1s, you know, and these are also what we heard. Not only that these are actionable, but these are things that as we looked at different communities, what is actually resulting in morbidity and mortality, what as we back up. But you're absolutely right. But this does not mean that protecting people from communicable diseases is any less important than improving oral health or preventing suicides. But thank you. So these our task this coming year, to Representative Olson, to your point, our task this coming year is basically to align these desired outcomes that we have across the state for this work with the measures, really concrete measures that we can hold ourselves accountable for, as well as our partners, that reflect some of a crosswalk that we need to do between the work that the CCOs have done with their assessments and their state and their improvement plans, with the county assessments and their improvement plans, and not-for-profit hospitals have done that same work. So given the Affordable Care Act implementation that you mentioned, Senator Bates, it's everything's like a little off by 3 to 6 months, and we're looking at these next 18 to 24 months of getting things more aligned, but beginning to have this conversation across all these sectors to say, you know, and it might be a different priority list in Jefferson County than it is in Washington County. But understanding that it's part of the statewide system, we have the same goals, but we may have to adjust what the investments and what people are prioritizing in different parts of the state. So tobacco, why do these public health people keep talking about tobacco? Well, because smoking tobacco is the single greatest cause of avoidable death and disease in Oregon. Tobacco use kills more than 7,000 Oregonians annually, and it costs the state $2.5 billion in health care costs and lost productivity due to premature death. The number of diseases tobacco use is related to as a root cause of that disease and contributing to increased illness and death include many conditions of the heart, the lung, and cancers. Part of the biggest challenge for us in our health status impact, understanding the health status impact of tobacco in terms of the prevention policy issues that we can work on, is we know that there's a sweet spot in the late teens and the early 20s where if individuals don't start to smoke, they won't smoke. They won't become smokers later in life. So the challenge of preventing youth and young adult uptake of tobacco products is really a very long term. It's a good strategy, but it's the long game for making sure that we can address these issues going forward.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Ms. Shirley, how is Oregon doing at continuing to decrease uptake in youth compared to other states? Do we know what the percentage of people under 18 who smoke in Oregon is compared to, say, Washington or California or other states near us?
Senator Steiner Haywood and Senator Bates, we can get that for you. I don't have them with me and off the top of my head, but that information is available, and I can make sure we get it to you.
That's great, because we know that preventing kids from starting smoking is, especially as they're younger, is one of the best things we can do to prevent long-term. I mean, addiction rates go up the earlier people start. So thank you.
Mm-hmm. This next slide is pulling out the percent of Oregonians who smoke and among various groups, to your question, Senator Steiner-Haywood, and teen smoking rates. This is one example of how we work to apply data. As you know, we talked earlier, information is, you know, our major product for Oregonians. And we look at data like this across different data points to know not only in general, for instance, who has the issue, but where can we find the issue? Where do we need to really work with the community, the communities involved specifically? So we look at this type of data breakdown so that our partners can understand, you know, where to emphasize their local on-the-ground community-based solutions as well. And we have this commitment to working with local communities, and it's predicated on partnering with them to meet their needs. So we look at things in terms of race, ethnicity, urban versus rural versus frontier, socioeconomic status, and age, including understanding differences in outcome for children, youth, and our aging population. And this is another goal of the Public Health Division, to really be able to share, to analyze the data that we have in ways that makes it more useful or actionable in local communities.
Can I go back to the last slide just for a second? Mm-hmm. I'm probably reading it wrong. Statewide average for adults is 17%. There's not a group here except Asian Pacific Islanders that's below 17%.
That's the aggregate. If we looked at almost all 4 million Oregonians, we would say that we had a smoking rate of...
Including children, then.
Including children, right.
Okay.
Yeah, all Oregonians.
Okay.
That would be our percent... No, I'm sorry. No, this is adults. This is for adults. 17% of adult Oregonians are smoking.
So why don't... What subgroup is less than 17% to balance this out?
No.
Asians,
14.
We haven't got that many ages in this state, I don't think. Yeah.
So can we get back to you?
Yeah, I'm curious.
Yeah, okay.
Okay. Do we?
Well, if you start adding all of the Samoans and everything, yes, you probably
would. Okay. Asian Pacific and Islanders. You may well be right. Southern Oregon. You know, we got two Chinese restaurants.
Right. So come to my community.
We're diversified. We are not diversified. Wish we were.
I'll introduce you.
Diversification there is we have a German restaurant. You know. So,
Senator Bates, yeah. I think our statistician or financial expert here has come up with...
Yeah, we get it.
I think that's a... Excuse me, Senator, members of the committee, I think it's a stretch to call me the statistician. but I think the answer to your question lies in that 17% of adults smoke, so therefore you're extrapolating and taking all population, including non-smokers. So you have a portion that represents the smoking population. Versus these other populations are very discrete, and within their populations, they have higher proportions. So, for example, 17% of the 4 million are smokers. It's not to say that there's less than 17% within these discrete populations. You're going to have some that are very high, and obviously
I just wonder what discrete populations are below. So, what is that? Any more time? I'm going to go back to my favorite author, Mark Twain. There's a lot of damn lies. And their statistics. So,
and Mr. Chair,
well,
I would invite you to my community when we have World Beat. World Beat is composed of in this city a lot of very diverse races.
Thank you.
That exist, and we do have a large Asian Pacific population.
That may be the answer. Thank you. Thank you. Please continue. I didn't mean to derail you too long there.
Okay. So one of the major drivers and leading causes of death in Oregon is obesity rates. And there are a number of activities that we perform and support in local communities to slow the increase of obesity. As you know, obesity is a complex end product of a lot of socioeconomic factors, as well as you know, other factors that influence people as in their life course. One of them is our infants and children's program. And we know that obesity causes a great deal of health challenges for individuals. It causes very many painful and expensive health conditions for people. And one of the most devastating and most expensive for individuals is, you know, the incidence of diabetes in Oregon. Since 1990, that rate has more than doubled. We went from 4% in 1990 to 9% for the last year that these statistics are available. And the rise in diabetes has definitely been mirrored by the rise in obesity, from 11% in 1990 to 27% the last year that the statistics are available for. So that this is something that that many of the programs in public health, while we don't have an obesity program in public health, there are many areas that we work on to reduce the rising incidence of obesity. I'm sorry, Senator
Winters?
Just because I'm very much involved in some initiatives here locally that we have started. One of the things that we found and through the educational part of it is that when you talk about obesity, we found that that became a turnoff. So people felt the stigmata. So we changed how we communicated in this community to health wellness. That, and in doing that, we were able to get, you know, we started here in public health is a part of this initiative that I started, the I Love Me Marion County 5210. And so we actually do have a tracking system now. We do have an app, in fact, that you can, individuals not only Marion County can join and track their success. But we did find that the word obesity had a very negative connotation to it. And so in getting to this point, we changed that and started talking about wellness. The other thing that we found in doing so and looking at ways of getting both parent and children engaged and involved, the CCO here now is actually involved with early learning. And there's a wonderful little book that is being out. Did I show it to you when you came to my office?
Yeah.
That I hope all CCOs will do. That is pictorial for not that you can then read to kids about fruits, vegetables, and what have you, where at that young age they can begin to understand. So I'm hopeful that all these various little tools will help to lower the rate of obesity and diabetes in this community. But we found using obesity wasn't working for us.
Thank you for your comments. Welcome. Representative Boone?
Yeah, and yesterday I had a group of my small farmers in my office and from my district in both Clatsop and Tillamook and Washington County, and they're trying really hard to get, they have a packet of bills they're working on, but one of them is to get more money for this farm to schools, and I see that in the next slide you have it here, but you know that we farm direct nutrition programs, $1 million. It's not a lot, but it's something. But I'm wondering if you can work or are working with the school districts, because that is one of the best ways to do it, is to teach the kids. And then in some of the schools down in, in Nehalem, and some have little plots, you know, in the school yard and stuff. And just a couple of plants for tomatoes, these kids fight over them, you know. And so when they bring that home, then the family can be engaged and kids can go shopping and they can, you know, pass along to their parents their healthier choices. And I just wondered how much interaction there is between the health authority and the schools, because that would be, they have to buy the food for the kids. And we have so many, we're working on free breakfast and free meals now. And so it may as well be good food. You know, and I'm wondering if there's any activity in that or efforts in that area.
Senator Bates, Representative Boone, thank you for the question. Absolutely. To the point that Senator Winters is making, you know, people live in local communities, so the work gets done and the handoff gets done, and that tomato goes, you know, to a kid in a local community, that booklet that mom gets is in a local community. On the state level, we really have upped our ante around that kind of work to get a collective impact. So we've been able to have, with the Department of Education, we've just signed a memorandum of understanding with the State Department of Education. Obviously, local public health departments work closely with their schools and their districts around the state. You know, we encourage that. We have a lot of work in the state level that supports those kinds of connections. But to get this kind of sense of a more of a collective impact, we do have memorandums of understanding. We just signed with the Department of Education because we know healthy kids, you know, these are lifelong habits, and healthy kids learn better. We have one with the Department of Transportation, you know, looking at what are the decisions that the Department of Transportation makes that may impact the health of a community. So we are really looking more at that kind of interrelatedness. It isn't just interrelatedness with the CCOs. It's kind of interrelatedness with what are all the collective variables that create, you know, that family, that mom having choices and living in an environment that can support health. So again, this is to Senator Bates' earlier point. This is all new territory. We're rethinking how we approach this. We are doing it hopefully thoughtfully and carefully to find out, like, well, what's the perspective from the education point of view around this work? What's the perspective from the community-based organization so that we can come up with a strategy, because we all have the same goal, but a strategy that we can all support and leverage together.
Well, just a quick follow-up that thank you. One of the things that these my constituents said yesterday was they're busy farming and they're busy doing that. They're wanting to open up their farms now to bring people in and engage them. But what happens is the groups, like I'm just thinking Food Roots and some of the groups locally in my district that work with communities. It's a community-based program and promote it, and they work with a food bank and everything. But the farmers need to stay on the farm and farm so they can actually grow the stuff. And encourage people to get their own plots, et cetera. But these groups that are community-based are put in the position of being competitive with granting agencies against stuff that's really not related to that. But if there's something in the health authority that, I don't know if you have a few extra, you know, kroner laying around somewhere, that they would appreciate those kinds of things to help them fund, even as a, you know, to get them started or something.
Because
there's a lot of volunteerism going, but stuff actually, plots and things cost money to buy supplies to build them and maintain them. So, but it's a really popular thing, and we have lots of, believe it or not, in the North Coast, we named 5 markets different days, and you could literally do all your food shopping in these markets, and extending to helping with 4-H and the kids who grow animals or raise animals and vegetables and master gardeners, all that stuff. It somehow it's got to get tied together, and they all do their individual outreach, but somehow maybe the health authority, just to add to your workload, why not? But it sounds like you're on the right track, and just anything that we can do to help tie this together, because I think it's going to pop. I really do.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate the question.
I do have one.
Senator Winters.
I do have and the nutritional part is very important. Probably one of the biggest challenges that to address the issue that's before us, and that's the challenge of activity and exercise. You know, we no longer have PE. We actually, when you know, talking about planning and looking ahead and how all these connections are, it's everything from sidewalks to walking paths to bicycles to whatever. But the big one, and how we've in our 5210 managed to connect in schools and activities, was convincing your PE instructors to become a part of 5210. And in doing that, that became the connector into our school systems. And it started with maybe one or two PE teachers, and then the others said, oh, yeah, I think that's pretty good, so I'll incorporate it. And it does take, and you're correct, from the community itself that began to take on these various tasks and activities. Because we've said we couldn't afford the price tag to mandate physical education in all their schools.
So just a couple quick comments, we'll get you on to the next slide. BCE, we all recognize, is the new epidemic in our country. And it's something we're going to have to deal with. And I see it as in your realm of your new realm of public health. This is an epidemic, and you should be treating it as an epidemic. I recently went through a process about a week and a half ago. When you turn a certain age, they don't give you a birthday party. They give you a wake. Okay? And it was basically a wake I went through. I figured they better do it now because I may not be around later. But one of the things I had a chance to look at was a fifth grade class of kids in the 1950s and a fifth grade class of one of my granddaughters. And the difference in where those kids looked was stunning. I mean, half the kids in the new class were clearly overweight, and I didn't see anybody in that other fifth grade class was overweight. We didn't have TV dinners, didn't have TV. I know it's shocking. And so we were out playing every night because we had nothing else better to do, and our parents probably didn't want us in the house anyway for very good reasons. And now the kids are got electronics. They got five TV sets. We know all the stuff that's going on. And so I do see it as an epidemic within your new realm of public health. And what I'd like to do, though, ask you to do, William, your epidemiologist, I'd like to track obesity against the decline of smoking. Mm-hmm. And one of the weird things going on is I have, in my practice, we work really hard to get people off cigarettes. They all gain 10, 15, 20 pounds and don't take it off. And I have women who go back on smoking because they don't want the weight. Yeah. And that's a very real thing, whether we like to admit it or not. And so I'd like to see if you could track those two over the last 15, 20 years and see what's going on. And nobody in my fifth or eighth class smoked, except the teacher. Okay. Okay. So it was interesting, though. It really, really brought it home to me, the difference that's going on right now. You have to take a smoke break?
Brownie break.
Yeah, you got smokes.
Thank you. Please continue.
Okay. So one of the things, when we talked about working as just one of the ways that we are, you know, approaching this epidemic, through really making sure that every person in Oregon who is eligible for a WIC voucher, every family has one. And just this slide just looks at the scope that you see. There are 550 local grocery stores around the state and corner stores and pharmacies that are WIC retailers. And this, the Farm to Direct, is actually, you know, a newer part of this program, as Representative Boone pointed out. But it was a new idea, and we tried it, and we're getting a lot of enthusiasm around that. The other thing that I think, when we talk about this kind of economic benefit, these are federal dollars that come into, you know, districts around Oregon, and the fact that. That we're looking at what we call leveraging multiple outcomes. So just getting people to go to a farmer's market or engage also has that side benefit of other ideas, you know, that social, it breaks down social isolation. So again, we may be tracking this one variable, but it has these other effects. And that's kind of what we want to get more sophisticated about in terms of understanding how can we bundle some of these initiatives together to really see, you know, what is the overall effect of walking your kids to school, socializing with people, maybe having a community garden together, that these are all benefits that go across the lifespan and include from children to the elderly in their benefits. I did want to just talk about, because there were some questions, the income eligibility for a WIC family of four is $44,000 a year. So it's someone who's only making $3,677. And that there were, you know, there have been some issues. I just want to assure you that there's an enormous, this is different than some of the issues that have happened with the food stamp program. It's WIC is very well monitored. You only get your coupons for a month. You can't, you know, kind of, they don't carry over. You can only use them in the state of Oregon. And we have a tremendous amount of monitoring in our state. We actually do more monitoring than the feds require.
Question. Because it's only for specific foods.
Correct. Yes. Healthy foods.
It's, and where SNAP is not.
Yes.
That, right. Yeah, that's
yes.
not.
Yeah. Yes.
I mean, it's outside of my.
I think there are
my
those,
portfolio.
Those of us who
yeah.
would like to yes. entertain and talk about maybe that particular one should also be for healthy
yes.
foods.
Yes, we should. But that's
and
the
so, and that was something that I think yeah. the good. Were you with me?
Yes.
For the good senator and I, with Women in Government, posed that you know we really need to take federally. They need to take a really good hard look at what mm. can be purchased and what happens. You with, you know, the same as what we do with WIC. It is to promote healthiness as well as to provide, you know, the value of what is needed and necessary. So I encourage anything that you can do towards that area, because here we are on one side talking about we want a healthier community. And there's several reasons for it. If you look at diabetes and cardiovascular diseases and the cost of those diseases, it's probably the one that we spend the greatest amount of dollars for on our healthcare side. I think they consume about 80% of the dollars, and they're 20% of the population. The other problem that has bothered me, and the reason I got so heavily involved in this, is that looking at the longevity table, that we're, if we continue on this pathway, the next generation is going to lose 10 to 20 years of their lifespan. That should be sobering to all of us when we start to think about what this particular one issue can produce. And so that was the motivation of getting me involved. One, not only the cost, because this panel deals with cost drivers, but also the fact that we could possibly be losing generations of individuals, which then goes into a whole host of other fallout. So I... glad that you're there and what you're doing, but I think we've got a lot of work to do.
Well, I just one final point, if I can. Representative Stark.
Oh, thank you. You guys thought I wasn't paying attention,
no,
huh?
No.
I am. With the, I'm wondering, are there any conversations about the functionality or accessibility for individuals using the WIC coupons? I very much believe in the WIC principles that I referred to and the idea of the healthy foods and how specific it is. There's a practical application problem. If you've ever shopped with WIC coupons, mm-hmm. or if you've ever gone, because all the different retailers do it different. Sometimes they bulk WIC stuff together. Sometimes it's separated. And if you've ever been in line yourself or behind someone where they separate out with the coupons, mm-hmm. I know several families, especially foster parents, that have stopped using WIC because they feel like the challenge of the coupons changing and the sometimes even 1% milk versus 2%. Sometimes those things have become a barrier, even though I'm very for the principles. And I'm wondering if there are things going on with those discussions.
Thank you for the question, Senator Bates, Representative Stark. There is a wide range right now. We are actually in the process of coming up with a WIC ID card that would be electronic. And it would also mean that we would have automatic, first of all, it would be easier for the vendors. It would be easier for the participants. And it would be easier for us to monitor because we would know what was bought where, when. So we'd be able to track it, you know, electronically. But it also... we're in the we think December we'll have those online or January. It's been a hard, thoughtful process to get the contract out and to pick a vendor and to make it so that it's specific to the the values and the criteria that we want in Oregon for that. So, Bill, do you have other things you want to talk about in terms of implementation?
No, I, members of the committee, Senator Bates, I think that Lillian just described is that there was a slight delay in the electronic benefits for WIC. We had hoped to be much further along at this process, but hopefully later this year.
So you're thinking this year. Great.
Senator Bates, represent end of this year. I'd rather under promise and over deliver.
Mr. Chair. Senator Stern-Hewitt.
This is relatively minor in the grand scheme of things, but I'm interested to know, and you may not have the answer, what the WIC program does to educate store owners and their clerks. I had a situation with one of my constituents who reported that she'd been in a grocery line with a young woman with a WIC card. They were out of whole wheat bread in this small grocery store, which is one of the things that WIC requires, and you're allowed to substitute reasonable alternative. And there was one that was like half whole wheat, half white flour, and the clerk refused to sell it to this woman on her WIC card. And I know that the rules allow for a reasonable substitution the ideal product isn't available. And this poor young woman was so terribly embarrassed, and my constituent just paid for the bread for her. But I really worry about that because, I mean, $44,000 a year sounds like a lot of money, and yet folks are it really isn't when you're talking about feeding a family of four and especially maintaining a healthy nutrition level during pregnancy and early childhood. So I just think it's really important that we don't create disincentives such as public shaming, essentially, for people who need to have the supplement, which, as we know, the mom having good nutrition during pregnancy is actually plays a role in decreasing lifelong obesity. So I just want to make sure that we're doing the right things to educate people who work in stores that accept WIC coupons, hopefully soon cards. So
thank you for the question and a reminder to continue to monitor that outreach education to the vendors.
Thank you.
Okay.
Representative Kenny Geyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just following up on the WIC electronic card, are there other states that are doing this? And also, did you consider putting it on the EBT card for ease?
There are other states that are doing it. I do know the answer to that question. And we have used them, you know, we've consulted back and forth to, you know, make sure that we don't, we can learn from other experiences. Mm-hmm. And I'll get back to you on the last one. I am reasonably sure that the Department of Agriculture rules would not allow for that. So, but I will, that's my understanding. But I can check specifically what would be the statute that would prohibit that in Department of Ag, Federal Department of Ag. Thank you for the question. Okay.
Thank you. I'm going to stop your testimony at this point and bring you back tomorrow as planned. Tomorrow you can jump into substance abuse and suicide rates and the rest of the stuff. Thank you for your testimony today. I know you may feel a little nervous, but you're doing fine. You're doing great. You'll have that. Representative Nathanson will be having the gavel tomorrow, so just watch out. She's pretty tough. I'm kidding. She's fine. And you'll do well. Okay. Thank you for your presentation. I do appreciate it. Committee, I thank you for your questions, and we will look forward to seeing you tomorrow. Senator Witcher.
Just a request when you come back tomorrow on the suicide rates that you have. And it would be very helpful. We talk about reduced suicide rate. I'd like to see a longitudinal because I think that it's important. If I look at those that are still relatively high, wondering how much of that impact is the recession and the actual, their timber-dependent counties, how much the economy has played in a role in those suicides.
That's a really good point.
And on a follow-up to that question, to help prepare to, we get ranked against other states, and sometimes the difference in different states' rankings is so minute it's hard to tell the difference. So if you can give us, you've got numbers here for a rate of 16 to 16.8 per 100,000. I can see what other states are doing as far as that actual rate is concerned.
And the number.
Yeah, the actual number.
Yeah.
And the other thing I'd like to ask, some of us cheated and looked ahead, you know. We've had a significant reduction in deaths from substance abuse, starting in 2011, especially for men. I'd like to know if that's related to the decreased use of methadone or some other factor. My guess is it's methadone, but I could be wrong. Okay? If you could tease that out of the data, I'd appreciate it. Thank you. And we are adjourned. Thank you.
That's why I get